The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's been a few weeks since I've been here, but when I was here, the last weeks I was here, I did a series of talks having to do with the Buddhist teachings and practices around self and selfing. And it's a teaching which is considered very significant in Buddhism, the teaching of not-self. But even more important is the teaching, I think, is the teaching around how we get attached to self and how we create a sense of self. And and why it's more significant is that if we look at the teaching of not-self, it's easy to get wrapped up and confused and tied in a knot around, what do these Buddhists mean? Obviously, there's a self here. That's how I got to IMC. The self brought me here. I brought the self or something. And it doesn't make sense to talk about not self. But if we talk about how we get attached to self and how we get self-conscious, self-preoccupied, selfish, that's much more you can relate to that. And then as we begin to dissolve some of the self-attachments, and then there can be very radically different experience of being a self or being alive. That sometimes in Buddhism is called experience of not self or understanding of not self. But even so, the teachings of not self, self and not self, is confusing. And one of the reasons it's confusing is the philosophical reasons. And there's a kind of the philosophy of self and the logic around, is there a self, is there not a self? And most people gravitate in that direction, as opposed to the experiential or psychological aspect of self, you know, how we actually experience a self and how we construct a self and how we get attached to it. So this divide between what I'm calling here philosophical and experiential. And so people tend to get wrapped up around the philosophical or get caught by that. And so I wanted to address this aspect directly today and then end with a little pointing to the more experiential. And now, in the philosophical side, it's very confusing to use the English word self. The Buddhist teacher has a teaching of not self. Because the teaching of self is not a very well-defined term in English. We think we know what we're talking about. But as a philosophical term, or as a kind of metaphysical term, as like, you know, it's not a very precise term. You know, what if you ask the question, what is the self? You know who you are as a self. If you say your name, someone calls out your name, you respond. But, you know, what is the self? What is the essential self, the true self? When you start asking questions like that, it lends itself to a lot of different possible answers. In fact, in English, we have a lot of different definitions of what it means to use the word self. And if those of you who studied psychology, different schools of psychology, each school of psychology, or some of them, have different definitions of what it means to have a self, or what it means to be a self, and what it means to develop a strong self, or all kinds of things. And so, if we use the word self without defining the terms, then it's very easy to miss ourselves. So if you're, we think we're talking about the same thing, but we're actually not. So, the Buddhist might say it's important to have the experience of not self. But what? I've spent countless thousands of dollars with my therapist to develop a strong sense of self. That's what we're developing and working here. Have I wasted my money? And what's this about? Now I have to undo it? And perhaps they're talking about the self from different definitions of it, different understandings of what it means. I'd like to propose that often the word self is the self is an abstract category within which different understandings, definitions, qualities are included. So whenever someone says there is no self or there is a not self, you have to ask, what do you mean by self? Does that make sense? So if you go back to 2,500 years ago in ancient India, the Buddha had this teaching that gets translated into English as a teaching of not self. But he didn't use the English word self. Right? And just a little footnote, Just like Freud did not use the word ego. That's the English translation of the German word for I, right? The I. And somehow these people translated Freud into English, chose the word ego, and then because of Freud, the word ego has become very important in the English language. But you know, just because of Freud, about a translation issue around Freud? I think I talked about that a few weeks ago. So, the Buddha didn't speak English, as far as we know. And he did not grow up in a Western American culture that has a particular cultural definitions or idea of what it means to be a self. So he probably was not referring to modern ideas of self, and he might not have known anything about Freud. So in his cultural context, in his time and place, the word that's being translated as self, what's it referring to? What does it mean? And the word in Pali is atta, A-T-T-A. Some of you who know a little about Hinduism or have heard the expression atman. So it's the same word. In Sanskrit is atman, and in Pali it's atta. So you know the Mahatma Gandhi, maha atman, the great self. That's what it literally means. Say it very fast, maha atman, Mahatma. Mahatma Gandhi. And so the Buddha has a teaching of not atta. So, and then it was very important for him that it's called anatta. A is not. And so, or an is not. And anatta is not atta. So what is atta? How did the Buddha understand what atta is? There was a wonderful Burmese Buddhist monk who taught here in the Bay Area for about 25 years named Usilananda. And he lived in San Francisco for a long time. Then he had lived in the monastery, Burmese monastery in Half Moon Bay. A beautiful man, very well educated as a Buddhist monk, a scholar kind of monk, practitioner monk. And I suspect that he could speak English better than I could speak it. He grew up in English-speaking schools in Burma and very well educated. And he wrote a pamphlet on this teachings of anatta in English. And lo and behold, he did not translate the word atta as self. He translated it as soul. A not-soul teaching as opposed to a not-self. As soon as you say not-soul as opposed to not-self, you're in a whole different conversation. What do you mean there's no self? That's confusing to me. But when you say no soul, then you get into a more interesting kind of, you know, I never even soul and a Buddhist. You know, I don't usually use that, you know, you might think, that's not something I think about. It's like God, you know, is there a soul? What does that mean? So he talked about Usilananda translated as not soul. So I mentioned that to kind of to open up, like, what do you mean, what does Buddhists mean by atta? What did the Buddha mean? Chances are the Buddha was responding to the philosophical religious ideas of his time that referred to the concept of atman, of atta. Was the idea that in a human being there is some kind of essence, permanent essence, that like a little small little seed perhaps or something. And that one of the goals of religious life is to realize that that little essence was the same as Brahma. And Brahma is the great, you know, it's hard to know, but the great cosmic God, the creator God, the great cosmic principle, the great ultimate reality. And to realize that the Atman was the same as the Brahman, that the little essence that you have is the same as ultimate reality, was the goal of certain forms of religion at the time of the Buddha. And so people try to do that, try to find the Atman, they try to discover it, try to discover how to have union between the Atman and the Brahma, and it was a big pursuit. So how did people understand this Atman? You know, really, what did people understand? What was the Buddha referring to when he used the term Atta? He did not define it directly, so we don't know. However, there's a beautiful discourse that the Buddha gave where you can, as he gives his teachings, you can, from it, you can tease out how he understood what the atta is. Those of you who are already getting bored, hang in there, because when we get to the experiential side of all this, I think it'll at least tantalize you. Awake. So this is a discourse, teaching the Buddha gave to his own son. And many people don't realize that Buddha had a son. And when his son was relatively young, he joined his father as a Buddhist monk. Actually, for when he was young, he was a novice monk, because you can only be ordained as a full monk when you're about 20 years old, as an adult. And so he spent many years growing up under his father's tutelage. And then the tradition says that when his son was about 20 years old, the Buddha gave him this teaching. And as this, it's kind of touching. I'm a father with sons. And, how do you teach your children? How do you pass it on? How does a great spiritual teacher, as a child, how do you relate to your children around your teachings you have to do? How do you train them? And so it seems that when his son Rahula was about 20, the Buddha determined that his son was now ready for the most profound teaching he had to give, teachings that would help liberate him from his deepest attachments, from his clingings, from his that which keeps the heart, the mind, constricted or tight or in bondage. So the Buddha went to his son and he said, come with me. We're going to go for a walk deep into the woods to a grove that was called the Blind Man's Grove. I don't know why it was called that, but it was called. He was already living kind of on the edge of kind of an urban area in the woods, in the forest. But he was going to go deeper into the woods with his son. And they were going to spend the day in the woods together. That's, again, I'm kind of a little bit touched, the idea of a father and son going off in the woods together, into nature, going for a walk. So he said, bring your sitting cloth. That's what they do. When monks sit, they have this square piece of cloth they put in the ground to keep stay clean, I guess. So they went into the woods, and they came to Blind Man's Grove. And some of these groves in India are quite beautiful. I don't know exactly what trees they had here, but in that area of India, they had this majestic tree called the Sala, which is kind of like the redwoods of India. Beautiful, big, majestic trees. And they have these beautiful, when the roots are high off the ground, they come down and make these kind of walls.
Banyan.
Not the hanging banyans, but, they make kind of, the roots come out and make this kind of, they call banyan kind of bottoms. They make these kind of like sections around you. And it's easy for me, at least, to imagine them sitting in this beautiful grove of trees, majestic big trees, in a very quiet place in nature. And that the juxtaposition of the teaching that you're about to hear in this natural setting, highlight something or make something more accessible. Certain things about the self of who you are changes, whether you live a busy urban life running around or whether you're deep up in the Sierras in the redwood country and by yourself sitting there, beautiful trees and so many ways in which you usually think about yourself seem irrelevant up there. So things change. Your sense of self kind of changes in some way. So here they were in a setting like that. And then the Buddha engages his son with not teaching him directly, but by engaging him in a question and answer process, and then inquiring with him, asking him questions, kind of help him kind of find his way to some kind of deeper understanding. So the Buddha said, "Rahula, what do you think? Is the I permanent or impermanent?" So your eye, your physical eye, is it permanent or impermanent? And the answer that the Rahula gave was, it's impermanent. It's not going to be there forever. Maybe it'll be there, you know, there until he dies, but sometimes people lose their eyes or eyesight before that. Those of us who have glasses realize that the eye is not a permanent fixed thing, but it's changing quite a bit and over a lifetime. So it's impermanent, it's a changing thing. And then the Buddha says, is what is impermanent, translation here is suffering or happiness, stress or bliss. And Rahula says, well, whatever is impermanent is suffering. Whatever is impermanent is stressful. So certainly I can tell you that there's a certain kind of stress with having poor eyesight. I mean, if I take my eyes, my glasses off, it's pretty stressful. I'd have to strain to, you know, I just see this blur of, you know, I can kind of tell there's people out there. But, you know, I can't tell gender or, you know, most of my anything. So if I didn't have glasses, it would be stressful for me. And it'd be hard for me to get around, it'd be hard for me to do ordinary things in life. So for whatever reason, he says it's suffering. And then he says, is what is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, fit to be regarded as follows? This is mine, this I am, this is my atta. This is myself in this translation. And Rahula says no. So here the idea is that I think the assumption is that it only makes sense to call something mine if you have some control over it, some mastery over it, some authority, some ability to engage and change it. You know, I don't get nearsighted. If I told myself that when I was 10 years old, you know, then I could say, well, it's mine. But I don't have any control over it. And I remember how surprised I was. I've had glasses, you know, most of my life. But then about 10 years ago, I was went to a supermarket and looked at a bottle that had very small little words on it. And for the first time, I couldn't read it. I you know, what? So not only was I nearsighted, but now I'm getting this kind of, you know, old age eyes too. So now I have to have, you know, bifocal lenses so I can see close up and far away and everywhere in between. So Rahula says no. And this is the answer the Buddha was hoping for. Whether you agree with this or not, this is a reverse way. If you reverse engineer this question, this is how the Buddha was defining or understanding what the atta is. The atta is meant to be something which is permanent. It's meant to be something which is blissful, and it's meant to be something which you have some control over, ability to direct or have say over what it does in some absolute way. And so that was the idea of a soul or this essence. And so you find in some schools of Indian religion the idea of a sat-chit-ananda. Sat is usually truth or being or what's real. Chit is mind, and ananda is bliss. So truth, bliss, truth, mind, or truth, consciousness, and bliss. That somehow the deepest experience comes with an experience of consciousness or self or essence being blissful. And then we have some control over it. So for the Buddha, the idea of the soul that he was countering was that idea, that there is a soul, you know, a soul or an essence, which is permanent, which is in its essence blissful, and which we have some control or say over. You're following? So when the Buddha said that that the body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations and activity is not self, and consciousness is not self, what he was meaning was that the body doesn't qualify as this essence that's permanent, blissful, and that's something you can have absolute control over. So the same thing for feelings, perceptions, all your mental activities and thoughts, and consciousness. So maybe you don't agree with that, but if you look at any of those categories, it's hard to see, you know, how they're going to be permanently, how they're permanent, because thoughts, feelings, perceptions, even consciousness, when you're paying careful attention, is arising and passing. It's hard to find as being permanently blissful. That's part of the change. Nothing stays the same. And it's hard to see that you have any real mastery or control over body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, mental formations, consciousness, and these things. So those standard, those kind of common ways of understanding ourselves don't qualify as the atta. So then you could say, well, that's okay, because I know that separate from that, there's a in the essence of my being, there is this, I know there's this essence, there's a soul, I just know it. How do you know it? It just feels like it's there. Are feelings permanent? Are feelings blissful? Are feelings, you know, something you have real control over? You know, where are feelings? You know, just a feeling, they come and go. You can feel all kinds of things. The scriptures tell me. Well, you know, what scriptures? Who wrote the scriptures? And you start to ask, you know, so if you can't find the atta, the soul, in your direct experience, where do you find it? And how do you know you have it? So the Buddha was then asking his son, in your direct experience, can you find the categories of direct experience? Those, if you look systematically through everything you can experience directly and leave nothing out, everything that can be known directly in your experience, directly, not by logic, not by scripture, not by someone told you, not by just feels like right or inference, and all the things you can directly experience, do you find anything there that's permanent, that's permanently blissful, and that you have absolute sovereignty over, control over? You have absolute say of what actually happens to it. You know. So, and Rahula said, no. So the way the Buddha did that, he went through these different categories. So first he said, the I. And then he said, forms, the shapes that the I sees, are they permanent? Are they blissful? And you have absolute control over the forms that you see, things you see out in the world. And then the eye contact, the act of eye perception, the way that we perceive, there's the eye, there's the object, and there's the perception of it. In the perception, is there permanence? In the perception, is there some kind of abiding bliss? In the perception, do you have absolute control over the perception? And now that we know how complicated perception is, it's hard to say that there's even pure perception unmediated by conditioning and all kinds of things that go on. And so Ruhula said no. So Buddha, so first he went through eye, then he did the same thing for ears. Ears, sounds, and the perception of hearing. And then he did it for the nose, for the tongue, for the body, and he also did it for the mind. And in doing this, the Buddha was trying to point out all possible realms of how we can know something directly through what the Buddhists call the six senses. You following me? So outside of those six senses, how are you going to know anything directly? What's accessible to you? And if everything that you can experience directly has these three qualities, then it cannot be the atta, the atman, that people believed in back in those times. You follow? So Rahula followed. Now Rahula, remember, he'd been monastic for many years, probably done a lot of meditation, very still, very quiet, had learned to let go of a lot of things, was probably not attached to a lot. And somehow, when mind is very still, very relaxed, very free, relatively free, there can still be a lingering kind of sense or feeling or attachment to some abiding essence, some abiding true being. This is who I really am. Or there is something here. And so the Buddha here was kind of giving him a guided meditation where Rahula was kind of looking for, in all the realms of experience, do you find anything which is my essence? And when he went through all the experience, he couldn't find anything, then there's a shift that happened in Rahula's mind. And the shift was, here, is described this way. The Buddha describes a shift that I guess he was hoping Rahula would have. Seeing in this way, a person becomes disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with objects you can see, disenchanted with eye perception, eye consciousness, and then disenchanted with feelings, perceptions, these mental activities and consciousness that arise with eye contact as a condition. So you start getting disenchanted with all the different things you can know directly. It's both the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. Disenchanted means your spell is broken. The feeling in Buddhism is that most people live under a spell where they assign promise to things in the world that aren't really there. They're kind of enamored. They're enchanted. They're under a magic spell of things. And we have a whole industry, advertising industry in the United States, that's really capitalizes, literally, on getting people enchanted, believing that, you know, you get if you buy this toothpick, you will have all the sexual adventures you'd ever want in your life. You look really wonderful and, you know, profound. And you get enchanted with that toothpick. It's going to do everything you need for you. And so, but the idea of being enchanted, that something is going to provide you with a true abiding security, safety, guarantee, religious ultimate reality, spiritual salvation. We have all these things we invest in and we get enamored in it. An important part of Buddhism is to get disenchanted, break the spell, break the trance that people often fall into. So here, with doing this kind of search, looking deeply at everything you can directly experience, then the Buddha said, then a person starts becoming disenchanted. As a person becomes disenchanted, but that's all he says here. In this discourse, that's all he says. And then it goes on very simply and says that Rahula, when he heard this teaching, his mind was liberated by no longer clinging to anything. So it's a beautiful story, I think, you know, again, of a father giving this wonderful gift to a son, helping his son become liberated. So here we see this philosophical side. What the Buddha was referring to was a very particular idea of self, one that people were attached to or concerned with or trying to organize their life around. So if you quickly or easily translate the word atta into the English word self, then we have a whole different associations with the word self than what the Buddha was referring to. You follow that? And so it's confusing for us. You know, the Buddha said there's no self, but, you know, but maybe he wasn't meaning our sense of self. It happens, I think, relatively, it's interesting that it does translate a little bit in the sense that the same principles apply. To the degree to which we look at any concept of self as being something that's permanent, that's something that is going to provide us with lasting happiness, or something that we have some kind of absolute control over, those beliefs might be a source of suffering in people. And when those beliefs can be loosened up, lightened up, then we stop clinging to those beliefs around self, then there's a certain kind of liberation that can come. We're as attached to our ideas of self as perhaps some of the ancient Indians were to their idea of atta. We just have our own. So it's a little bit, you know, teachings of not-self that Buddha gave still kind of work, but it's a little bit complex because of the different reference points. Does it make sense? So I know this is kind of dry stuff, philosophy, but now you probably, hopefully, never forget and be a little bit wiser when you hear Buddhist teachers quoting the Buddha, because it's too easy for teachers to kind of do it kind of gloss over these differences or not be sensitive enough to these cultural or religious distinctions that go on. And I'm as guilty as anybody. So that was the philosophical side. And now I want to do the experiential side that maybe will tantalize you or liberate you or annoy you. And it's something I taught yesterday for those of you who are here. I apologize to do it again. So, say you're with a friend in a really silent place. Maybe you're in the redwoods, beautiful place. It's really silent and still, amazingly still. You've never been in such a pristine, beautiful, refreshing place of stillness, of silence. It just feels so good. It's like finally the refrigerator turned off. Just, oh, and you kind of feel this, oh. You didn't realize you were tense a little bit, and the refrigerator goes off, hum goes up, and ah. So really quiet. And then you say to your friend, I can't believe it's so silent. Is it really that silent? There must be some noise here. And guess what? As you say it, you've made it. As you say, there's some noise here, there is some noise here. It's your voice. And then you go on and say, you know, I don't really believe in silence. Silence has no purpose, and there's not really any silence at all. And you know, I've been looking for silence and thinking about it and talking about it and you know, wondering what the nature of silence. And I keep looking and listening and talking. And, you know, I just find any silence. You know, just like, just all the noise, you know, it's just noise. People are always talking. And I don't believe in it. It's absolutely not possible because, you know, probably your friend will leave you. But the very search for silence by speaking is impossible, because as you keep speaking, it kind of takes the silence away. We talk to ourselves all the time. I mean, most of us do. I don't know about you, but not all of you, but I don't want to speak for you, but I suspect that, you know, a good percentage of the people here are constantly chattering in there, in your mind, thoughts, images, ideas, kind of going on and on. And it's kind of like that noise. And that the thinking that we have in our minds isn't often just neutral, quiet, relaxed thinking. It's often driven. There's compulsion, there's tension, there's pressure, there's agendas, there's fears, there's you know, a lot of things that go on there. And sometimes they're searching for something. People who are on spiritual quests are searching for something. And so their mind, maybe the thinking mind for now, is searching, is looking. But if you're always thinking, if you're always thinking these words in your mind, or if you're always searching, looking, then there's something which is not available to you. Just as much as the silence is not available to the person who's constantly talking. If you're thinking about a place, so if you're thinking, where is the true self? Who am I really? I have to find myself. I have to know myself. Let me try to analyze who I am. Let me try to remember all the stories of my life, because that'll tell me who I am. Let me try to understand how I am with other people. Let me try to, you know, search and let's find the self. Who am I, right? And you're constantly engaged. One of the things you'll notice is that what's always there is this thinking, searching, pressure or tension, this movement. Cognito ergo sum, which is, I think, therefore I am. So therefore, the true self, who I really am, must be found in the searching, in the thinking, in the consciousness that's kind of directed, looking out, because that's all there is. I mean, not all there is, but it's always going on. But what if it's just like the silence? As long as you're talking, you can't know the silence. As long as you're thinking or searching for who you are, you can't find it, because it's not found in thoughts or in searching or in efforts of the mind to look anywhere. The very idea of looking someplace, that very effort gives birth to a certain kind of activity, or it is an activity, that gives you a location, a place to be. And so it feels very intuitive then, oh, I'm here. There's this kind of felt sense of being here. Just as if I tighten my fist, I feel the tightness, the pressure, the hardness, the pain. And I say, oh, now I really know there's a hand because of the tension. My true hand is in the tension. But if I release the tension, I won't feel much hand, but I then have a more useful hand. If there's this very subtle tension in the mind, that tension can be confused for who we really are. But the tension is not required. And occasionally the tension in the mind disappears entirely. But then with that tension gone, if you then say, well, who's the true self? Who am I really? Guess what? You've added this noise, you added this activity, this pressure, that in a way is kind of both self-defeating and gives you the wrong impression. It gives you the idea, oh, there is this thing here. The talker is the real self. But what happens if you stop searching, stop thinking, and allow the silence, the stillness just to be there? If you allow awareness to operate, to be aware, without doing anything with awareness, without directing it, without the mental activity that refers back to me, I'm the one who's experiencing something, I'm the one who's aware. Because it's a mental activity that says, I'm the one who's aware. And many times that operates in such a subtle level that we don't even know we're thinking that. But still an activity, I'm here and you're there. When that activity is put to rest and there's only awareness, then the Buddhist tradition says that there is no location for that awareness. It's not localized. Because to be localized, there has to be that little pressure or tension or activity of selfing, of thinking, of searching, of referring, of orienting oneself, of finding oneself in relationship to things. And that activity of selfing is optional. It doesn't have to be operating. For most people, it's operating all the time. So when the selfing stops, and we allow ourselves just to be aware without any reaction to our experience, without any putting any definition or labels in our experience, without defining ourselves in relationship to the experience, just having the experience, then there is no location for awareness. If there's no location for awareness, then there's no you in that experience. If there's no you here, then there's no there. There's no here nor there or anything in between. And then the Buddha said, and just that, with no here nor there or anything in between, without any location, just there is where we find the real full liberation from suffering, from freedom. So this points back to this idea of who are we? It's a classic question, important question. And it says something about what we might or might not find if we keep searching. Or what we might find if we stop searching. And the Buddha says at some point you have to stop searching to allow something totally different to happen than the usual ways in which we understand ourselves and the world. And it's such a place where it doesn't make sense to say anything about self. Because to say something about self, to make any statements about the self, is just kind of, is besides the point. No sense of self, no idea of self, no construction of self happens in that open awareness. If you come out of that open awareness and say, well, that open awareness is the self, that doesn't really make sense. They're just awareness. What does it take to experience open, liberated, free awareness without definition, without fear, without desire, without compulsion? Generally, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of time and practice, and a lot of relaxation. So I hope that this complicated discussion about the philosophy of Atta in early Buddhism, one way or other, will encourage you to relax. At least to relax around this Buddhist teaching of self and not self. There was one of the monks came to the abbess one day and said, "This Buddhist teachings of not self, we don't understand it." And the abbess said, "Yes, it's true. The teachings on not self is quite challenging until you realize there's no self who's challenged." So, thank you.